Hello out there. Welcome to the fourth in our series of seven deadly podcasts on Smart TV. This is, again, of course, your host, D. Roberts Keenan, bringing you the hump sin of lust, fourth in our series of seven, as we talk about Smallville. We're focusing today on Season 2, Episode 2. It's called Heat. And how appropriate, since, you know, Clark is discovering his heat vision, or as Television Without Pity likes to call it, his ejaculations. That's a wonderful, wonderful word, whoever came up with that. We are sort of going to be talking a little bit about lust, about the many different kinds of lust, and we're also going to be talking about Smallville itself. For those of you who don't watch Smallville, and I'm assuming that's a very, very small number of people listening to this right now, Smallville tells the story of the formative years of Clark Kent, the boy who would later grow up to become Superman. Now, the television show Smallville veers quite far from the canonical Superman Clark Kent mythology, where sort of Clark was Superboy, and there was a short-lived TV series by that name based on the sort of decade-spanning comic book, Superboy, in which he was fully aware of all of his powers. He had the whole uniform. He fought crime. You know, he wore glasses as Clark Kent. If you've never seen Smallville, you might be a little bit surprised at what they've done with the character. Here, he doesn't know where he's from. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't have the baby blanket that would later become his, you know, sort of costume. He is, you know, very confused about things. He doesn't know all of his powers. And in this particular episode, we're going to get a little closer to one of his powers, his heat vision. This is one of the sort of, this is one of sort of the prime Kryptonian powers that he has in the comic books and in the other movies and the television series and in sort of the other ways that he's been presented. And here we're seeing heat vision as a direct metaphor for lust, for that sort of sexual tension, for that heat. Clark, of course, as any teenage boy, is unable to control his sexual frustration, and it comes out of him in these sort of spontaneous emissions. I don't think that's an accident, and it's almost certainly not an accident when we see them come out for the first time. The Discovery Channel, blah, blah, blah. Lust, as we're talking about today, this is all throughout this episode. I mean, all throughout. Clark has obviously got the hots for this woman, his new biology teacher. And as they're watching a video on sex education, she's, you know, she's touching herself in a suggestive way. We get to see the sweat dripping into her breast crevice. You know, I love Chloe. I love her looks. I love Allison Mack. I think she's a brilliant, brilliant actress on this terrible, terrible show. And I will be the first, and probably not the last, to tell you that as bad as this show is, I love it. I cannot get enough of this show. Okay, here we go. Did you see the sweat dripping into her breast crevice? And then now, all of a sudden, he's ejaculating with his eyes at the same moment that the sperm is trying to penetrate the egg on film. This is so not an accident, people. Okay, whoever made this show knew exactly what they were doing. And we love it. Although, I am not the only one who thinks that Clark is completely gay. Yeah, gay for Lex. So gay for Lex. Lana is just a complete twit, and we all hate her. But we all know it's all really about Clark and Lex, and there's a term for that. Yeah, it's called being gay. Being really, 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 really gay. And when you've got Lex Luthor, who is like the sexiest supervillain ever, and when you've got Superman, who is just, you know, like the most iconic superhero ever, you've got it. You've got it completely made. Sometimes when I'm watching this show, instead of Save Me, I like to sing Spare Me at the top of my lungs. That's just me. That's just me. Okay, we're done with the opening credits. We're back, and we're about to get the first of many big reveals, which, you know, is completely ridiculous because this story appears to have been taken directly out of some old Super Friends cartoon. But anyway, Of course, Lex is getting married to this strange newcomer. This was always happening in the comic books, by the way. Like, the peripheral people in Clark's life were always getting married and being invaded by alien brain sources and all sorts of things, while Clark remained completely oblivious. But here we go anyway. We've got Lex and Desiree, and if that's not a complete come-on sort of name, then, you know, I don't know what is. Desiree Atkins, which I think is just a hilarious name because, you know, Desiree, obviously, desire, heat, lust, blah, 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 and Atkins because she's, you know, obviously a great beneficiary of the Atkins diet, but that's just my own, you know, that's just my own little laugh at this. Oh, we're about to get it. Oh, the gayest look of the episode. Yeah. Poor Clark. His heart just breaks for Lex as he discovers that... Yeah, as he discovers... Lex is getting married and is going to be off-limits to him. Here it is. Oh, poor Clark, your eyes. You look so hurt and wounded. Yeah, gayest look of the episode is something Television Without Pity came up with, and I am so not above sort of, you know, using them. I'm assuming most of you people have heard of this site, if not, you know, been there and, you know, done that. They're not us and we're not them, but I have no problem, you know, quoting them as long as I cite my sources, as they would say in the academic world. This is not oral plagiarism. Lust, a little bit removed from the Smallville, because here is just a bunch of boring crap we don't care about right now. Lust, as far as the seven deadly sins goes, was something that most of the theologians who discussed the seven deadly sins would talk about at length. And it is not considered the greatest of the seven deadly sins by any stretch of the imagination. Pride occupies that top spot. And depending on which order you look at, it comes either fourth in the list, as we are putting it here, or it comes dead last. But lust is the sin that the most ink has been given to, quite obviously. It's the thing that most people were concerned with. It's what the Puritans would, you know, recoil the most against, this sort of sin of the flesh. And the way that it breaks down is lust was considered to have sort of one of four different manifestations. Number one, you could be basically self-love, sort of allowing yourself to, in the words of Thomas Aquinas, procuring pollution without copulation, which is just sort of a kind of a funny alliterative phrase, for the sake of venereal pleasure. And this Thomas, I will read you exactly his quote. By procuring pollution without any copulation for the sake of venereal pleasure, this pertains to the sin of uncleanness, which some call effeminacy. This meant, okay, from this sort of standpoint at the time this was being written about, that if you like to pleasure yourself, then you were a woman. I mean, that's basically where it comes from. They thought a normal masculine man would not want to pleasure himself. He would want to, you know, pleasure himself inside a woman, not with his hand. And you, by using yourself to pleasure yourself, you were not as masculine as you might be. Now, I am well aware that there are two types of men. There are masturbators and there are liars. And within this context, we can see that Thomas Aquinas was obviously a liar. But, you know, he blah, blah, blah. He was this great theologian and, you know. Okay, I just have to comment on that image right there. Again, another blatant piece of sexual imagery as the champagne cork bursts and bubbles come spewing forth. Okay, but now we're back to Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, that was the first type of his love, was basically this masturbatory pleasure. That was the first type of lust that one could indulge in. The second had to do basically with bestiality. It was copulation with something not of your species, which, as an aside, means that any person who has sex with Clark is technically committing bestiality and, you know, therefore ought to burn in hell forever. But, you know, I say that just to throw that out there, just whatever. Okay. third, by copulation with an undue sex, as they call it, basically the sin of homosexuality, which, you know, is the vice of sodomy. So we've got masturbation, bestiality, sodomy, and fourth is sort of an ill-defined realm here, whereas we talk about sort of not observing the natural manner of copulation, either as to undue means or as to other monstrous and bestial manners of copulation. Now, it seems to me that the first three cover pretty much everything that is the non-procreative sex, which that's, I mean, it would seem to cover it right there. You've got bestiality, masturbation, and homosexuality. Basically, everything that, you know, is not, you know, is not sex man plus woman, which is, you know, the sin of, you know, contributing to the sin of lust. But this fourth realm sort of covers all the gray areas. It covers the sexual arousal, but not to orgasm. It covers the oral sex. It covers anal sex. It covers, you know, mutual masturbation. It covers everything that, you know, they it basically is not missionary sex position. And this was considered part of the sin of lust. There were three other types of, three other manifestations of the sin of lust that could be man plus woman, that could be procreative sex, but were considered foul and detestable. One was fornication, one was adultery, and one was incest. Fornication is two people who are not married who are copulating. Adultery was two people, one or both of whom may have been married, but not to each other. And incest was basically sex with someone you are related to. Of those three are written about at length in the Old Testament as being things that were desirable. And so those could be excused in some way. But the four other things that I've mentioned, you know, the sort of the masturbation, the homosexuality, you know, the bestiality, the other various and sundry acts of sodomy, those were considered as never excusable. Those were like the worst types of lust, because not only were they sins against sort of, you know, right actions, they were sins against nature, and therefore they were just evil and foul. And there was a time in history when one could be put to death for these acts against nature, which is, you know, a really good thing that, you know, those sort of mores have passed, because I have a feeling that a great many people, both straight and gay, would be put to death for these sort of unnatural acts. You know, and I'm using unnatural strictly in this sense that I'm, you know, talking, I'm not making any judgments about, you know, you or your decisions to get, you know, to get it on with your honey. I'm simply speaking in a historical sense here. As we get a little bit back to Smallville, Clark and Lana, this is a romance that, of course, we know is doomed to failure, because we all know what happens to Clark is that he grows up and he falls in love with Lois Lane. And, you know, he marries Lois Lane, if you believe what's going on in the comic books. We know that Lana will end up with Pete, and that Pete will end up the vice president under Lex Luthor, and this is all stuff that is sort of canonical in the comic books. And we know too that Smallville deviates from that sort of canon. But we also know that it can't really go too far. There are certain things that Clark has got to do. There are certain things that must be met. We know, for example, Clark has to come from the planet Krypton. We know, for example, that at some point Clark has to be able to fly, even though he can't at this moment. We know that Clark has got to be invulnerable to bullets. We know that, you know, kryptonite has got to render him, you know, weak and vulnerable and could kill him. We know all these things, and these are things that cannot be separated from who Superman is. And, you know, and here, when, you know, we know We know that Clark plus Lana equals failed, doomed, you know, dead relationship at some point. And yet these early shows are surprisingly poignant to us, because it's this whole first love concept. We know that it is exceedingly unlikely that anyone with a first love will end up, you know, with that love for the rest of their lives, but we can't help rooting for it anyway, you know, against all hopes. This whole sequence here where Jonathan is trying to get, you know, Clark to control his power, just this strikes me as absolutely hilarious. We know what this heat vision is a metaphor for, at least in the context of this episode. We know it's a metaphor for sort of, you know, spontaneous ejaculation. We know that it is a metaphor for uncontrollable sexual energy. And so substituting, you know, the real for the metaphor, this just becomes absolutely laughable. His father is trying to teach him how to masturbate. I mean, that's what's really going on here. He's trying to teach him control. He's trying to teach his son to take this sort of sexual energy and go with it and learn how to sort of, you know, do it on command. Which I think there are very, very, very few fathers who would ever be that honest and ever be that open with their children about that sort of behavior. As we see the scarecrow just sort of erupt into flame. Clark is so flame. Yeah. Okay. I think also this is hilarious because as we, you know, yeah, he's popping the Jiffy Pop with his eyeballs. Anyway, yeah, okay, I'm so over this. We know what Clark is going to do. Okay, little sight gag, just like the champagne bottle. I mean, it's completely obvious. The writers knew exactly what they were doing when they made this. But let's all be adults here. And let's get back to talking about the dirty, naughty, horrible sin of lust. Lust. Lust, oh boy. Okay, I cannot stop commenting on, you know, this whole fire metaphor for sex. Yeah. Okay, now, if there were ever any proof that Clark is gay, we're going to watch it here with Desiree, as she tries to seduce him just as she seduces every other man on the face of the planet. And Clark is the only one who's invulnerable to the womanly wiles of this vixen, this Desiree Atkins diet. Yes, she's totally trying to come onto him. We're about to see the purple come out of her mouth, which seems a metaphor for rape, almost. She is raping these men. This essence of hers is coming out of her mouth, and she is entering these men by force. You know, she is forcing them to do that which they do not want to do. And if there were ever a more fitting metaphor for rape than this, I obviously haven't found it in this episode. I find it amusing that everything in this episode is so blatant, is so one-dimensional as to this. But when you consider the show, and when you consider this awful, awful show that I love so very, very deeply, you realize that is all the show operates on. There is nothing beneath the surface. There is no subtext here. This is all exactly what it appears to be. She is trying to rape him. He is invulnerable. You know, so she's going to go and she's going to try to make his life miserable in some other way. And she's going to go to rape. She's going to go rape Lex again. And she's going to end up trying to rape Jonathan. You know, I mean, this is all, you know, this is all such this weird reversal. And one really has to question sort of, you know, the stance on morality that the writers of this television show take. But, you know, anyway, a little aside here. I have always thought that Clark and Chloe should end up together. And when they introduced Lois later on, I believe it was season 3, when they introduced Lois into the show, perhaps it was season 4. Season 3 or season 4, someone will have to remind me of that. I think it was season 4. Anyway, okay, whatever. when they introduced Lois into the show, and she's Chloe's cousin, I never, never, never believed that that was the Lois Lane. I am one of the people who subscribes to the Clois theory, which means that something horrible, horrible is going to happen to the Lois Lane as played by Erica Durance, and that Allison Mack, a.k.a. Chloe, is going to assume the identity of Lois Lane, and that this is the archetypal Lois Lane, that this sort of this savvy, smart, brilliant reporter is going to take on the initials LL, and she is going to be the one that Clark ultimately falls in love with. It is only too obvious that Clark and Lex have a thing going on. There is a tension between them. It is something both more and less than a brotherly affection. They honestly care about one another, but they are so sort of drawn to and then repelled by each other. It's just something that has always fascinated me about the Superman character in the comic books, not necessarily in the very fine films, at least the first two, Christopher Reeve, where we never got that sense of, you know, him and the Gene Hackman character, you know, being the same way. But in the comic books, at least, there is this very real attraction and repulsion between Clark and Lex, between Superman and the world's predominant supervillain. And here we see a taste of that. They want so badly to be with each other. Lex had asked Clark to be his best man, for instance. And, you know, here they, you know, there's really something there between them. And it is, you know, if you go back and if you were to read, you know, all of the Superman origin stories, and you were to read the Superboy comic books from the 1960s, you would see that, indeed, Clark and Lex were best friends, and that, you know, if you trust to the first, you know, or sort of the considered the most predominant ideas of the Superman origin legend, that it was Lex who was this scientist. He was trying to devise a cure for kryptonite for Superman, and or for Superboy, and Superboy inadvertently, you know, ended up setting off this chain reaction of explosions that left Lex completely bald, that destroyed Lex's laboratory, and in a fit of rage, you know, basically Lex called off the honeymoon. I mean, he destroyed the anti-kryptonite that he had developed. He vowed that he would always be Superboy's enemy, not realizing Superboy and Clark Kent were the one and the same. And this sort of grew into this weird, you know, into this weird love-hate thing, because Lex would be so drawn toward Clark Kent and would be, you know, able to be, you know, pleasant and friendly toward Clark, but toward Superboy there was this whole animosity thing. And so this would really develop over time. Now, Smallville does like to play with the canon, as I've said, and it really plays off this whole idea of, you know, Clark and Lex being drawn to and, you know, sort of angry with each other, and this happens again and again and again. Right now we're in season 5, which is airing right now, and Lex has just sort of turned to the dark side. And he did it because of Lana, and I think that's just a ridiculous reason, because, you know, Lana isn't supposed to end up with Lex, she's supposed to end up with Pete, but of course they wrote Pete out, blah, blah, blah. And I could go, you know, on about this, but we're not talking about that, we're talking about lust. This is a really interesting sort of lesbian scene here. If you go back and if you watch this with the dialogue, you know, there's a look here, there's a look there. These women, you know, Chloe and Lana, there's this heat between them too. And I can't help thinking that this is absolutely deliberate. But, you know, they're both sort of cautioning each other, and they're both sort of saying, you know, let's leave Clark out of this, you know, let's define ourselves. Yeah, okay. So Lana just says, you know, I don't want Clark to become us in a friendship. And Lana says, let's define ourselves by what we do, not who we date. You know, and that to me seems to be sort of a coded message here, that not only do we have to worry about Clark and Lex getting it on, but we have to worry about Chloe and Lana getting it on. This all, I just, you know, whatever. We see a little bit of the awkward tension between Lana and Lex, and we see what happens when you let lust get the better of you, how lust, this sin, can destroy your relationships with all these other people in your life. This would be a very popular medieval theory, that the reason why you must turn away from lust, the reason why you must prohibit yourself from having these unnatural obsessions, from having these unhealthy relationships, is that it will destroy the good relationships in your life. And when we talked about gluttony, we talked a little bit about that. When we talked about envy, we talked a little bit about that. How those particular sins will cause you to turn away from God and will cause you to turn away from the spiritual aspects in your life. And here in lust, the most temporal of sins, lust the most earthly, the most bodily of sins, how that will cause you to turn away from the things on this earth that are good and that are decent and that are holy. I mean, and this is a very literal interpretation of what lust was and what lust means. I mean, for example, if you are having an unhealthy physical relationship, as defined by these theologians, by Thomas Aquinas, by every other person who's ever expounded on the dangers of lust. For example, let's say that you are, you know, you're participating in oral sex, as we would all love Clark and Lex to be shown doing. If you are participating in oral sex, by definition, you are not participating in copulation. You are not participating in something that will lead to procreation, because you are wasting, quote unquote, your essence, your, you know, whatever it is. And this was something that at that time and in that place was considered so, you know, abhorrent, that one would have this, you know, that one would waste one's seed in such a way, that is why lust got elevated, at least in the popular mind, into such a completely, I mean, in, I don't know, I think it got way out of proportion, but that's my opinion here. And I have the benefit of, you know, 500 or 600 years of history backing me up with that. But, you know, here we go with, you know, Clark and Desiree, and they're having this sort of standoff there, because in a very weird sense, I mean, in a very, very weird sense, Clark is trying to save Lex from the sin of lust. And, I mean, that's so, at the one hand, that's so sweet and that's so, you know, that's so heroic of him. At the other hand, that's really weird. We do not talk about lust with our friends. We do not talk about, you know, aside from sitting in the locker room with a couple of guys, and, you know, frankly, I've never actually witnessed that, but, you know, aside from that sort of idea, we don't sit around with our friends. We don't go out to brunch like, you know, Carrie and her friends on Sex and the City and talk about all the people that we are having sex with. We don't talk about how often we masturbate. We don't talk about how often we, you know, we have oral sex with someone. We don't talk about that sort of thing. We don't talk about our lust. And it's kind of a pity in Western culture that we are so sort of prudish about this. But at the same time, watching it here, watching this sort of extended metaphor, we realize that Clark is really weird. I mean, he's really is the outsider. And it's kind of fitting that later Clark will be built up to be this sort of, you know, Superman, is this messianic sort of Christ figure. I mean, that is just the nature of what Superman is. Superman is this unearthly visitor with these exceptional powers that he uses for absolute altruism and to do absolute good. This really is a Christ-like figure. And here we're seeing just how much of an outsider he is, that he is getting in between the marriage of his best friend. You know, he's trying to end this. He's trying to stop his friend from sinning, and he's not trying to stop his friend from robbing a bank. He's trying to stop his friend from, you know, committing the sins of the flesh. this is just one more, I mean, if you really sit down and think about this, this is just one more way in which Clark proves himself to be something that is not human, proves himself to be something that is not of this earth. Clark is not Lex's brother, he's not his father, he's not any sort of a power figure over him, and yet he's taking it upon himself to save Lex's soul. Now, we can be coy and snippy about this and say that, you know, Clark is trying to save Lex for himself, which is the opinion of quite a few people on the message boards, actually. Here, Martha is trying to do something very similar to that, although I don't think that she's doing things like, for the same reason that Clark is. Clark, who will eventually become the ultimate altruist, this self-sacrificial sort of figure, this superhero, is at this point, you know, trying to stop Lex because it's the right thing to do. Martha's trying to stop Lex because she sees it's hurting Clark. And, you know, it's not quite the same level of altruism here. They're trying to perform a similar task, but for different reasons. And it's you know, the motivations behind that are, there's a subtlety there, but it is, in my opinion at least, a distinct and important subtlety. Again, here we're going to see Desiree rape Jonathan, rape yet another man. And I'm using the word rape very, very deliberately here. We often think of rape as this thing that only a man can do to a woman. And here, as we see in this episode, it's really not that simple. This is a woman who is quite literally penetrating a man with this purple haze that comes out of her mouth. She is, you know, she is using this penetration to further her own ends. This is a very, very literal look at what Desiree is doing. She is raping Jonathan. She is raping Lex. She has tried to rape Clark. And, you know, this too is a form of lust, you know, obviously. This is sort of, you know, this is an unlawful means of achieving sexual gratification for her. Later we're going to talk about, you know, pheromones, and Chloe is going to have her own theories, and, you know, she's a meteor freak and yada yada. All that stuff is completely unimportant to what the actual essence of what is going on here. She is causing Jonathan Kent to turn away from his wife and sin. She is causing him to turn away from his family. She is causing him to turn away from God as he takes a gun against Lex. That's what's going on here. You know, I love it when Chloe plays detective. And I'm going to mention that I love Veronica Mars, and that I think that Kristen Bell and that Allison Mack should totally, like, you know, when they form the CW, I think that they should totally end up having a spinoff episode where, like, Chloe comes over and helps Veronica solve a crime, or maybe Veronica comes to Smallville and helps Chloe solve a crime. And I just think that would be just so completely awesome if we found out that they were, like, long-lost sisters or something. Because, yeah, they look so similar, and there's something about both of their attitudes that just makes me think they would be fabulous together. And I throw that out there just to throw that out here. That is completely not related to the lust that's going on here. But, you know, say it just to say it. If you're synced up with me right now, then you've just heard that really hilarious line where, you know, where Chloe, you know, says, "Luckily for us, Clark appears to be immune to some members of the opposite sex." Which, of course, is completely hilarious from so many different standpoints. Number one, that, you know, that Clark is an alien. I mean, he is a completely different species other than human. Number two, that if you follow the fan postings, you know, that Clark is completely gay for Lex. I mean, and that's why he's completely immune to members of the opposite sex. I mean, there are multiple readings. I want to mention that when I set out to do these commentaries, I watch the episode, you know, and I take a few notes. And then when I'm actually recording these, I turn the sound way down and put the subtitles on. And this is not the first time that I've recorded this particular commentary. This is actually the second time. My first time had a couple of technical issues, and so I had to redo it. So now, in the space of a few days, I have now seen this episode 3 different times. You know, once completely and twice with the sound on. And it's really interesting to watch something like this multiple times, because you see, sort of from a completely technical standpoint, you know, you see all of the camera movements, you notice all of the lighting changes, you start to notice the little ways and means that they put this thing together. And I just think that's hilarious. But I also think that the dialogue in this episode is so completely hilarious. I would love you to sit down, you know, after you listen to this, if you would, turn on the subtitles on your DVD and follow along with the spoken, and so you can actually read it right there. And you're just, I mean, to hear it is one thing. It's there, it's gone. But to actually read it is so completely ridiculous. This is really just ripped out of sort of like every hokey serial, every sort of comic booky, and I'm using comic booky in a derogatory sense here. Every sort of, immature literary, means, every sort of little weirdo little trick that you can see, and you'll see how completely hokey this is, and you'll see that it's completely wrong for me to love this show as much as I do. Here, of course, we get to see Clark using his ejaculations to great effect. And I love how it just like completely breaks up, and for a moment there, this is all in slow motion, you see this bullet just sort of melting into this big, huge sort of floating coppery splooge. Okay, now, there's nothing so deliberate in this particular show as just watching that bullet go sort of... Again! Okay, oh my god, Desiree, again, raping with the legs. We laugh and we laugh at rape on this commentary, but that's really what's going on here. It's all so deliberate, and... There are so many images and metaphors for sex and for lust and for sin in this particular episode. It almost becomes like a parody. I mean, it really is showing so many of the different manifestations of this particular sin here that it be. Oh, the little rainbow there. Yeah, the little rainbow wind chime. Okay, tell me that this is not completely homo, but. So many different ways that it really is, it's almost a satire. It is like a morality play of, showing the dangers of lust. And they're throwing in so many symbols at us that they're really trying to pound it into our heads how evil and how horrible it is when you can't get the better of your sexual urges. And so this, of course, becomes a metaphor not only for teenagers, but, pretty much everyone. Don't let it get to you, don't let the naughty thing take over your naughty place, or you'll end up almost dying. You'll end up almost killing your son's best friend. You'll end up, fill in the blank. And so the more that I watch this particular episode, which I hadn't seen in, quite some time, the more you find it just absolutely hilarious. This whole season, as a matter of fact, now that I reflect on it, is really, really funny. And it's really funny for all the wrong reasons. It's really funny because it's not supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be serious, and it's supposed to be all angsty and like teen power and sort of accepting the responsibility. But the tone is completely off. That the more I watch of season 2, the more I am reminded that it's so completely ridiculous. This is, Smallville like this is equivalent to sort of like, Buffy at its worst. And when we talked about Buffy last time with the sin of gluttony, we mentioned a couple of the little fan bugaboos. And, here we see them sort of all right there. Everything is right on the sleeve, and everything is, so out there. Everything is so blatantly obvious and in your face, and this is the message of this particular episode, and in a way that is so completely fitting for what we're talking about. And we're talking about lust, which is the sin of the flesh, which is this earthly desire, And I just have to mention that Lex just touched Clark, and now Clark looks all sort of wistful and, you know, sort of moody. That is so fitting for this particular sin, because lust really is out there, and lust really is visible. And no one, you know, I mean, think about this. No one can see your envy. You know, if you're envious of something, nobody can see that. Everyone can see your lust. I mean, as a man, everyone can see your lust, if you know what I'm saying. That, too, is quite a medieval perspective. That is something that Thomas Aquinas would have agreed with. It's a gift from Lex. Okay. I haven't yet brought up Hoye, and I promised Liz that I would. Liz, as you know, is the webmistress and founder and editor-in-chief and all-around fabulous person behind Smart TV. Liz made me promise that I would talk about Hoye. And Hoye, for those of you who read televisionwithoutpity.com, is short for homoeroticism, yay, which basically means any episode of Smallville. Because there's always some sort of weird homoerotic buddy-buddy thing going on between Clark and Lex, and it just makes you want to sit back and go, yay, boy, get some. We all know that Lex and Clark are destined to be mortal enemies, just as we all know that Clark and Lana are destined to be failed ex-lovers, and we all know that, you know, Clark and Lois are destined to be together someday. And as much as we know that right now, and with everything so on the surface as it always is in Smallville, that, I mean, Lex and Clark really should be together. And some part of us thinks that they probably are, and that's why Clark was so moody. And that's why Clark was trying so hard to break up Lex's marriage. Because he wanted that big, beautiful, bald man all to himself. All to himself, I tell you! That's. I haven't really talked about Whitney. Whitney being, you know, sort of Lana's quarterback boyfriend all through season one. And we all knew that this long-distance relationship thing was so not going to work out. but, yeah, Lana and Whitney is something so pitiful. It's just because Whitney was such a cipher of a character. He was really not a very interesting character. He changed motivations all the time, and now we see that Lana is about to tell him the truth. And, of course, we know that the truth is cutting to credits. We all know that the truth between Lana and Whitney is that there is no future for Lana and Whitney, because Lana is destined to be with Clark and then to have her heart broken and then to end up with Pete Ross. And we all know that Whitney is going to die, you know, because Whitney doesn't really exist outside of this particular, you know, this particular little television show. But we all know that lust is bad. And we all know that you've been listening to the fourth Smart TV commentary on the delightful sin of lust, the hump sin, if you will. And we hope that you will tune in again next time. Again, this is D. Roberts Keenan. Thanks for listening.